All right, if you've been here for the last couple months, you know that we've been going paragraph by paragraph through the book of James. And now that we've finished James, we're doing a couple sort of unconnected sermon topics. Next week, we're talking about ascension. The week after that is Mother's Day. We'll talk about parenting. But today is Gem Sunday, and they've been studying the book of Esther. So today's sermon, when I saw on the calendar, we're out of James. We're going to talk about the book of Esther, a decision I made before I thought about how tricky the sermon is. Esther is not a really easy book to cover, but the gems have been learning from it, so we're going to learn from it today. So let me open up the book of Esther, and before I do that, let me just set the sermon up this way. Here's a problem that I run into. There are times as a Christian where somebody has faith, I'm going through life, and I ask God to act. God, could you do something? Say something, I've got a problem, and I will pray. And I'm just going to admit, I ask God to do stuff, and I don't have a clear idea that he did something. And when that happens, to be really honest, I get confused, and sometimes I even get nudged toward doubt. What I want, I'll just be honest, what I want is behind each step in life, a firm sense of exactly what God's doing. And I got a bunch of options. I'd be happy with an angel from heaven talking to me or a voice from heaven. I'd be even happy with like some sort of message in the clouds. That'd be fine, right? But here's what my life is like. I pray for rain like Elijah, and I have no idea why it rains. It rains, and I don't know for sure that it's God. It could just be the weather. Or I'll pray for healing, and when someone gets better or worse, like I get so confused. I wish there was a simple way to go, God did that. It's not just medicine or healing. When I make a decision, I would love to have like a thumbs up or thumbs down shaped cloud just so I know what's going on. But this is my experience as a Christian. Maybe it's yours. Sometimes I pray and God seems silent. In fact, even when good things happen, it feels like a coincidence and not providence. I'll pray for rain, and it happens to rain, and part of me goes, what a coincidence, it's April. Like, I don't know what it is. Or my kids will pray to get better from their cold, which I love kids praying, and then they get better, and part of me is like, yeah, kids get better from colds, right? I'm not the only one, right? You go through your whole life wondering, where is God? He seems so silent. Are the things that happen to me, is this the hand of God, or is it coincidence? Do I trust God, or am I just going through life experiencing all the things that happen to me? I'm not the only one to wonder this, right? You've asked this question. Now, that question, I think that is what the book of Esther is about. I think the book of Esther is far more than a princess tale. It is a provocative message about providence that help out people like me who look at all the coincidences in life and wonder what's God and what's not. And this message is a little bit different than normal, but I'll just give you a heads up, it has three parts. The first thing I'm going to do, I'm just going to tell you as quickly as I can the story of Esther. It's a kid's version, in case you've never heard it, or if it's been a while. And I would recommend, I'm not going to do a good job, I'll be honest. You're going to have to go home and read the Bible version. It is worth it. There's details I can't touch. But I'm going to start off by telling you the short version of the book of Esther. Second, I'm going to go back and look at some of the details. There are things that stick out that you miss if you just hear the story the way it's often told. There are details that you've probably missed before. And then third, we're going to ask the question, what might God be teaching people like me who walk through life and wonder, what is God doing here? Now, let me just start off with the book of Esther, the way that you may have heard the story before. The story takes place, context is important. It happens during one of the darkest chapters in the story of God's people. If you know the Old Testament, there was an Israelite kingdom. There's David, Solomon. I've got props here. This is great. Thanks, Gems. There was a kingdom of people who eventually rebelled against and turned against God. And God, over hundreds of years, over and over again, gave his people the same message. It went like this. If you worship God, God will bless you. He'll prosper you, all that things. And God says clearly, if you don't worship God, if you don't listen to God, God said, I will punish you. And that was the message that happened during the era of the kings. And people did as we do. Lots of people said, God, you're nice, but we've got actual problems here. And God's people says, we're going to figure out what's working and do that. And they followed what the Bible calls false idols as a way of getting the sort of success and power that they want. So they tried to gain power with all sorts of forms of money and sex and power instead of God. And a lot of that looked like going, well, let's look at what the really big successful empires are doing. Let's look at Egypt, Persia, let's just do what they do instead of trusting God. And God essentially, in the story of the Bible, said, God said, I am so powerful. Not only am I better than whatever power you're envious of, God essentially goes, I am big enough to use those empires that you are in awe of to move them around like little pawns on my giant chessboard. In fact, God says, I'm going to use these mighty empires to punish you, my rebellious people, which is exactly what happens in the story of the Old Testament. The biggest empire, the most brutal armies on the planet in unstoppable force invaded Israel. They took spoils, they took captives, they toppled the crown. I've always wanted to do that. And they just brought God's people into exile, and God brought the most powerful armies on the planet to punish his people. It's the exile, the darkest moments for God's people. Some of them said, you know, God must be real. They worshiped God. And to be honest, if I were one of those people who repented, if I were like, okay, God, I got the point. I'm going to obey you now. I'd expect God to do something instantly. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Here's our story that takes place during one of the darkest period of God's people. It takes place in an evil, dark empire. And the stars of the story are faithful people trying to worship God with renewed faith. Let me tell you the story. In the citadel of Susa, the capital of the Persian Empire, King Xerxes ruled over a vast kingdom all the way from India to Ethiopia. In the third year of his reign, he gave a lavish banquet for his nobles and officials that lasted 180 days. So 180 days of a feast, showing off his vast empire, proving his unquestionable authority, influence, and power. Incensed, angry, when Queen Vashti, his queen, refused to obey his command to show up, King Xerxes moved on, and his advisors suggested gathering the most beautiful young women to the citadel, and he would choose the most beautiful to be the queen. Among them was a Jewish orphan, Esther, cousin to Mordecai. Mordecai raised her with a father's care. Esther won the beauty contest, was chosen as the next queen, even though she chose not to reveal her Jewish identity on the advice of Mordecai. Meanwhile, Mordecai heard a plot to assassinate the queen, reported to Esther, saved the king's life. Years later, the king promoted Haman the Agite to height, and they all obeyed and knelt before Haman. Mordecai refused because of his Jewish faith. He would only bow down before God. This enraged Haman, who devises a plot to destroy not just Mordecai, but all the Jewish people in the whole empire. Through flattery and a pledge of wealth, Haman deceived Xerxes. A lot of manipulation here. Xerxes issues a decree to annihilate the Jewish people on a certain date and take all their resources. When Mordecai heard of this, he and the Jews fasted and wept. He urged Queen Esther to risk her life by going uninvited before the king to plead for her people. And after fasting herself, the courageous queen went to Xerxes, who extended his golden scepter in this amazing scene, allowed her in, and over two consecutive banquets, She exposes Haman's evil intentions and the Jewish people. And in an outrageous reversal, the king had Haman hung on the very gallows preferred for Mordecai. The king issued a new decree equipping the Jews to defend themselves against their attackers. And they all lived. The end. All right, that is the short, raw version of this story. The Bible version is a lot more interesting, more details. Let me just tell you two things that are true about the story of Esther. Young girls, for some reason, they love the story. And if I had to guess, I think it's because it's a story about a beautiful, young, dressed up young woman who's a princess, dresses up, makes a difference. If you love a good princess story, you'll love the book of Esther. Here's the other thing that's true. Pastors and theologians do absolutely not like the book of Esther. They don't like it at all. Martin Luther famously said he wishes that this book in the Bible, quote, never existed. And I can find lots of other people who just ignore Esther, don't talk about it, leave it off, list of books. I would guess a lot of you in this room have heard hundreds of sermons without really talking about the book of Esther. Why do theologians not like the book of Esther? Let me explain. The Bible is generally about God, about God speaking to us, acting, God saying something to us, or people who follow God. And there's something, like, out of all the books in the Bible, there's something weird about the book of Esther. You know what it is? In the book about God, there's nothing about God in the book of Esther. There's no, like, lessons. There's no, and God does something. And even, like, you know, the characters, you'd think they fast and pray, but it only says they fast, which is weird. There's no, like, you know, the emperor wanted to kill Daniel and God closed the mouth of the lion. Like, nothing like that. God's not doing stuff. There's no, the prophet prayed for rain and God sent rain. Nothing like that. There's no angels and dreams. And the entire book of Esther, you don't even see the name of God mentioned. There's no angels showing up. There's no, like, it's just life. It is what theologians would call very secular life. God's people are threatened, they're in danger, and maybe they pray, I mean, they at least fast, and it sure doesn't look like there's no, and God heard their prayers and did whatever, like, nothing like that, which makes the book fascinating. At first glance, do you guys know what sarcasm is? That's sarcastic. Everyone knows what sarcasm is. Here's my, like, thesis. Esther is written by Jewish people. And I think most of Esther is written in the sarcasm font. And here's the problem. Old German theologians don't understand sarcasm. So Martin Luther just doesn't get it. But you know what? You're at an advantage. You're in New York, the home of some of the best sarcastic Jewish comedians, right? And some of you had a lot of training how to do this. I think the best way to understand the book of Esther is to imagine, I don't know, read it with a voice of, like, Billy Crystal in the back of your head or something, or Jerry Seinfeld or Jon Stewart or any of these hilarious Jewish sarcastic people. And you can almost imagine, like, Martin Luther reading a late night monologue going, this doesn't make any sense. Lots of people don't get sarcasm, but you do. So you're at a huge advantage here because I think Esther is designed to be hilarious because it's making a sharp, true point. And here's the joke. Jokes aren't funny if you have to explain them, but here's the joke. The empire, the people you think are in charge of the world, they're the joke. Sarcasm is really powerful because it conceals with humor an agenda. And here's a joke, I'm gonna let you in on it. Power and success, what you think is running the world, they're not actually running the world. They're not as powerful as you think they are. In the story, everybody thought that the biggest people in the empire, like those people were actually powerful, but Esther tells a hilarious story that points to the fact that the empire is not in charge. Let me tell you the joke. So the first character we meet is this pretentious King Xerxes, the most powerful man on planet Earth. In fact, this is a faith crisis for lots of believers because they, like, faith says God's in charge, but they just watch this powerful emperor invade, destroy Israel. Most likely, he's the reason why Esther is an orphan. He's very, very powerful, commanding hundreds of thousands of people. This guy, let me tell you about the most powerful person in the world. He throws a six-month-long party to show how powerful he is and how respected he is. Which, by the way, is what you do when you're super secure, right? That's sarcasm, by the way. But you got the spotlight on him. Everybody's looking at how he's the king of the world in a very literal sense. Everybody is bowing, kowtowing, talking about how great he is, highlighting his unquestionable respect and power. And you know how our story starts? He's kind of knocking on the door of his wife's room, asking her to come to the party. Like, he's going, honey, lots of people are here. I've got a party to show off that I'm the most powerful, most influential person on the whole planet. And the empire is going, please come to my party, please. And his wife just goes, okay, most powerful person on the planet, sorry I'm busy that day, and the next day, and the next day. And Xerxes, at the start of the story, is just pictured standing outside the door, just going, pretty please, please can you come? Which is a hilarious image for the most powerful person on the planet. That's how it starts. And by the way, the next thing he does is he issues this terrifying judgment to his wife. Hilarious details. He pulls, I'm not even kidding, this is what he does. He tells the queen, well, because you refuse to come to my party, not even kidding, because you're not coming to my party that shows how powerful I am, you know what I'm going to do to punish you? I'm not going to invite you to my party. And I'm going to leave you alone. And she's like, oh no, please don't make me do exactly what I wanted you to do. Like, again, sarcasm. But that's how the story goes. He more or less goes, okay, I'm going to find another date. And that is the entire story of the book of Esther, starting with someone who's just profoundly powerless. The opening scene of Esther is everybody making fun of the king of the world. And by the way, funny detail, because he's a laughingstock, he issues a memo. Like, here's what he writes to everybody. Here's the verse. When the king's edict is proclaimed throughout his vast realms, all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest, sign the most powerful man in the world. Like, this is like what he does. He can't get his wife to show up at his party, so he sends a memo to say that, wives, you have to respect your husbands, signed King Xerxes, which is hilarious. By the way, this is not any hints for a healthy marriage, but let me just give you a hint. Sending memos that you should respect me is just a bad marriage practice. If you're stuck writing edicts to tell spouses to respect each other, you're already sort of on a bad note. I'll just say I wish I could deliver this like a Jewish comedian. I'm not Jewish, I'm not a comedian, but the material is really good. Like, and Esther's making a really sharp point. And here's the point. The guy who you think's in charge is probably a joke. He's not really in charge. Someone else is. And maybe trust in God instead, because the king who wants to make a spectacle of his wife makes a spectacle of himself. The vaunted monarch whose law could not be changed. And by the way, if you read it, he keeps saying, the law that cannot be changed. It's like he's just manipulated by everybody in the story. That's the first character. And by the way, it's easy to laugh at him because he's a joke, but everybody was afraid of him. One of the reasons why God's people got punished is they were more afraid of the king Xerxes than they wanted to worship God. And I don't have time to go through this theme in a lot of detail. It's there, but the next most powerful threat in the story is a guy named Haman. And if you ask the story, what controls Haman, you'll see a bunch of scenes where, I mean, he basically goes home and his wife, Zoraz, makes fun of him and bosses him around at home, which is why he goes, acts out, which is good comedy in antiquity. Haman is someone who you're afraid of, but he's just trying to get made fun of a little bit less by his wife at home. Again, I wish I could deliver this right, but Haman gets made fun of a lot, but he is the dangerous, feared, driving force between annihilating God's people. But in the book of Esther, he's a bit of a punchline. By the way, in the book of Esther, Haman tend to represent all the world forces that God's people are terrified of. And Mordecai starts to represent what it means to look like, to be fearless in worshiping God. And the story continues by Mordecai doing the right thing. He saves the life of this king who he hates, but he doesn't get noticed or rewarded. Instead, coincidentally, Haman gets rewarded and honored, but sometimes, this is hard news, but sometimes doing the right thing doesn't pay. Sometimes you see the worst people get ahead. That's the story of Esther. And Haman, I mean, everybody's afraid of the guy, but Esther just makes fun of him. He's a bit of a joke. Let me tell you why. First, he gets mad because Mordecai doesn't bow. I'm really mad at you, Mordecai, because you just stand there. And then he gets even more mad because the next time Mordecai just sits there and doesn't stand. Haman just upset any way you get. Mordecai is pictured as being more worried about what God thinks than what people think, a lesson of the book. Haman is, he tries to kill the Jews, but in a weird shift, he doesn't tell anybody the nationality of the people he's trying to eliminate. But he gets in trouble because you know who else kept the secret? Esther. So what a weird coincidence there. Haman, who intends to destroy Mordecai and the Jews, shocker, coincidentally destroys himself and his own family. In fact, the very gallows Haman sets up to kill Mordecai is where the king puts him, another big coincidence. Haman's edict really specifically was to take all the wealth of the Jewish people, but in the storyline, the Jewish people get all of Haman's wealth. What a coincidence. Haman writes this script where he gets the credit. Like the king goes, what would I do for a person that I want to honor? He tells him everything, and then Haman says, do it to Mordecai. And it's a very, very funny scene that you just go, what a weird coincidence. Haman gets to wear this royal signet ring, and eventually his enemy Mordecai gets it. And I sometimes wish I was a hilarious, clever Jewish comedian like whoever wrote this book. By the way, this is really good material. If you know of someone who riffed off this, I'd love to hear it. I'm just not funny. Comedy is sort of just not my thing, and explaining jokes it's not very funny. But I got a simple point. I think a lot of people, unlike you, don't speak sarcasm and completely missed what I think is a really provocative message in the story of Esther. And I think it'd be different if Martin Luther could watch a lot of Jerry Seinfeld, but he missed out. Here's why I think you're supposed to get from all the details. It's really crazy to think about it. Let me give you a short list. What a coincidence. I mean, Esther was in the right place at the right time, and she won a beauty contest. That's the coincidence. What a coincidence that she gets picked over everybody else on that stage. What a coincidence that Mordecai is in the right place and overhears an assassination plot. Next coincidence, somebody wrote it down. That's a coincidence. Oh, Esther didn't tell anybody she was Jewish. Another coincidence, the king saw her uninvited. Who would have thought? And weird coincidence, the king couldn't sleep at night and randomly asked to read old records to put himself to sleep. Next coincidence, the scribe is reading from, of all places, the story about Mordecai saving his life. And another coincidence, the king was awake enough to reward Mordecai and actually did something. And we can keep going and say, what a coincidence, over and over and over and over again. But sometimes if you say, what a coincidence, enough times, you draw the conclusion that maybe it's not a coincidence. Maybe there's no such thing. The way the author tells a story is by piling up a narrative where the main hero of the story isn't mentioned a single time. Because nothing in the story is a coincidence. It can't, like mathematically, it can't be. The only way this story makes sense is if God is in every one of those details. That each coincidence is mounting evidence, making a single point that you need to hear and you can't miss. That God, even working behind the scenes, is bigger than you can picture. That God is in the history, that he is in your life, in Esther's life. He is acting, even if silent, in ways that you don't always get to see. Esther is well written in that the author tells a story where God is doing everything, but he's behind the scenes. From the beginning of end, God is in every detail without giving any credit or being named even once in this book. And I think this teaches us something really important about God. I mean, think about how big of a message this would have been for the Jews in the exile, going through just amazing chaos and suffering. Think about all the readers sent. So you go, God, why are you silent? What are you doing? And Esther says, well, I'm doing everything. You just don't always get a message from an angel. This is a huge message. Please don't miss this. God's action in history and in your life may be just as hidden as in the book of Esther. You know, maybe what God's doing isn't easily seen. You may go through entire life and never get that message from an angel, right? You may never get a point in your life where you go, this is definitely God speaking to me. But that does not mean he's silent. The fact is, just because we can't see what God's doing, nothing is beyond the reach of God's providence. The story of Esther teaches us that God is at work around you, even if you cannot see it. And I think one of the ironic things is that as you go through your life, there's no such thing as coincidence. And by the way, realizing or believing that God is sovereign, that he's in charge of things, it doesn't let you off the hook. I mean, part of the story of Esther is that, you know, Esther doesn't go, well, God's in charge, I don't have to do anything. Like, she takes risks, she is courageous, and we should be too. Where God's purposes and plans are hard to see, it still is really important to obey and be faithful. And sometimes it becomes more obvious. Folks, that's the lesson of the book of Esther. And here's what I believe God might be telling you this morning. I believe that God being at work, you know, it doesn't often sound like a voice from heaven. God at work in your life doesn't, it probably doesn't look like an angel showing up and telling you things. You know what God works through? Everything. Even in the parts of life that feel like coincidence. God is big enough to work through the normal stuff. And all the stuff that you may be afraid of or respect the most, the thing that you may believe is threatening you, I mean, for Esther, it's probably just a joke compared to the power of God, even if that's really hard to see. But if you could see it, if you could keep walking, believing that God was in all of it, I think that would change you. You'd be braver, you'd be more secure. You'd have an easier time walking out in faith. You would, in fact, be fearless if you could see that God was at work around you. I mean, what could stand against you knowing that God is at work in all things? Esther is more than a story about a princess. It's an invitation. It's an invitation to trust in the Lord. If that's a new concept to you, we'd love to talk to you about what the gospel is, about how God is glorious and how he loves you. If you're not a believer, we'd love to talk to you about that. But if you're not a believer, I want you to take the book of Esther as an invitation to keep walking through life, follow God, obey him, trusting him to work out all things together for his glory and your good. So Father in heaven, sometimes it's hard to believe that you are king when it seems like there are so many other forces at work and against you and against us. Father, like the people in Esther, we long to have a clear communication of what you're doing, an explanation of why you allow things. But God, I pray that you would help us to worship you, O King, to trust you, that you are in control, that you are at work around us. Help us to be brave, courageous, and faithful as we worship you, O King, in all things. I ask this in the powerful name of Jesus. Amen.